Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. People in rural parts of Tanzania and other areas of East Africa face a lot of challenges, but life there can be particularly difficult for people with albinism. Albinism, of course, is a genetic disorder that causes a baby to be born without melanin. Melanin is a pigment that gives skin color and protects it from the sun, and people with albinism have pale white skin and hair. Unfortunately, in parts of East Africa, some traditional healers believe that body parts from people with albinism have medicinal or magical properties. Nearly 200 people with albinism have been murdered in Africa in recent years, according to the aid group Under the Same Sun. Hundreds of others have been abducted, attacked, or had one or more limbs amputated. But these attacks aren't the only challenges faced by people with albinism in East Africa. On this edition of Global Journalist, we'll hear more about this form of discrimination. And to kick things off, we're going to talk to Perpetua Senkoro. She's an advocacy and human rights officer with the organization Under the Same Sun. She joins us from Dar es Salaam in the Tanzanian capital. Perpetua, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here this morning. And I guess, first of all, most people, I think many people, at least in the U.S., are most familiar with the term albinos, but that's actually not one that is in common use now. Can you tell us just about that at the top?
Yeah, that is because many people forget that we're our humanity part. When they call us albinos, or here there are many words that locals use, it's like it's labeling us in a way. That is why activists like us prefer people with albinism or persons with albinism. Or if you know my name, just use my name so that you can elevate my humanity and then focus upon my condition. That way we are able to promote the rights of people with albinism as well as their welfare.
Well, good. Well, tell us, if you would, about just a little bit about your life. What was it like for you growing up in Tanzania?
The biggest challenge I faced was in primary school, because my teachers did not know about how to handle my condition. I didn't understand my condition. And with the visual impairment that comes with lack of melanin, that I had was really giving me difficulties in terms of participation in the classroom, because most of the notes were written on the blackboard. Most of the tests were given through the blackboard. I couldn't see what the teacher was writing on the board, and each time I participated in tests, I couldn't read the questions on the board. So I found myself failing most of the time. The only time I could pass my exam was if the exam was printed. And that was really rare, a few times. So primary school was really, really difficult for me. I hated school during that time.
And I understand that in some cases, even the family members, the mother or father, they may not accept or welcome a child with albinism. Is that still the case?
Yes, here it's still the case. For me, it didn't happen to me because my family accepted me from the beginning. But I've met so many cases in which the father abandons the mother once the mother has a baby with albinism. Apparently, many people do not easily accept that you are an African, you're black, and then suddenly you deliver a baby and they're white. So the discrimination usually starts from even the midwives, from even the doctors, the nurses. So that is why it is really difficult for many of us to be accepted in our families just because of that.
And there have been a number of media reports in recent years about attacks on people with albinism. Is this something that has been exaggerated or hyped in the media, or is this something that is really, really occurring? That's part of reality.
It's really occurring. In the beginning, in 2008, 2009, the reports were really high in number. But as we kept educating, I'm talking about Tanzania, as we kept educating the public about albinism and the challenges pertaining to it and how to deal with them, the reports went down. But right now we hear the reports coming up in our neighboring countries like Malawi, Mozambique. So it is not exaggeration, it is reality.
And so the traditional healers, or the witch doctors, if you will, what is it that they believe? What is it that they are after when they're seeking out body parts or hair or any of these sorts of things?
I think it's all about money and lies, because most of the people who consult them, which are too many in Africa, go to them because they need something. Politicians go to them because they need to win elections. Fishermen go to them because they want many fish. Miners go to them because they want minerals. So different people consult witch doctors, and when witch doctors receive such customers, many of them advise them that, okay, you need a hand of a person with albinism, or a hair of a person with albinism, or a leg of a person with albinism. And you find that there's too much lust, so all they care about is just getting the body parts so that they can get rich. But we question ourselves. I mean, if I have albinism and I have all the body parts, I should have been the first one to be rich. So if somebody is looking for my hand, I'm not rich. How comes the hand is going to make them rich? It's something that we ask the public each time we go out to educate it.
Well, I understand that actually one thing that some aid organizations do or rights groups do is they have sort of protection homes or protectorate houses in some parts of Tanzania. What purpose do those serve?
I can't call them protection homes as such, because many of us working in this field do not have enough funding to have homes as homes. But we have few victims that we are able to take care of because of what happened to them, the injuries they sustained in attacks. But here in Tanzania, for instance, when the attacks were very high in number, the government established different centers that people with albinism could go to where they fear that their security is at risk. So there are centers that have been established by the government. But for us, we have only few people that we are taking care of because our funding is not that much enough.
Well, you mentioned some of the challenges that you faced in primary school, but it sounds like for you, things got better as an adult. Why did things become better for you? Is that the case for most people with albinism?
I guess the higher I went, to high school, to university, I didn't have to read the board that often. I eventually got a laptop, and you know, with a laptop, you can magnify the font. I was introduced to teachers who preferred printing notes than writing on the board. So that made things easier for me, different from primary school. I didn't have that. I only had the board for most of my time in the classroom. So that is why I was able to get better environment as I went higher in school.
Well, one other question that I want to ask, and it sounds like that as things improved for you, it sounds like there was more understanding and perhaps better treatment. There's a woman with albinism in Kenya named Grace Mumbi Ngugi, I believe. She's a judge on the High Court in that country, and I was reading an interview with her. She said that when she, as a child, she recalls going to a hospital, and the doctors there didn't even know that she might need glasses or special glasses. She said she didn't wear sunscreen until she was 17 or 18 years old. So you got the sense that, she even came from a fairly wealthy background, but you still get the sense that there wasn't a lot of medical knowledge there. Is that still the case?
Mostly. And that is why when we go out to educate the public, we specifically target hospitals and health workers. And the groups in the hospitals that we meet, we go to, the groups we speak to, we realize that even nurses, midwives, doctors, many of them are in the dark in the subject of handling patients with albinism, handling challenges of people with albinism. We have a small package, we call it Understanding Albinism. When we go to them, we present it to them, telling them what albinism is, the challenges, and they're like, oh, I didn't know that. Now you're meeting a medical doctor who didn't know what albinism is, who didn't know what happens when a baby with albinism is born. So we have so many of them. Still knowledge is needed in the health sector.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about the challenges faced by people with albinism in East Africa. We just heard from Perpetua Sankoro about her perspective on growing up with albinism in Tanzania. We've got two other people who follow this issue closely coming up. But first, I want to remind you that if you want more Global Journalist, visit our website, globaljournalist.org. There you can find our program archives, as well as dozens of interviews with journalists from around the world, living in exile because of their work. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. To broaden our discussion now, we're going to bring in two other guests. Joining us from Marshfield, Wisconsin, is Murray Brilliant. He studies the genetics of albinism and is deputy director of the Marshfield Clinic. Murray, welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Diane Vogel in Arlington, Virginia. She's a former public radio show producer and is now director of outreach for the Asante Mariamu Foundation, an aid organization that works with people with albinism in East Africa. Welcome to you.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, Murray, let me start with you. You've done research on albinism for a long time. It's something that is more prevalent in some populations than others. Where does it most frequently occur, and why does it happen where it does?
That's a very good question. So albinism is found in all ethnic groups and all populations, all human populations, and also all animal populations as well. So in mammals especially. We find high frequency of albinism in specific places. One of the highest areas where concentrations of people with albinism is in Panama among the Kuna people who live in the San Blas Islands. There we find more than 1 in 100 people have albinism. As this show is more specifically about Africa, we do find albinism, especially what we call type 2 albinism, to be extremely common in some parts of Africa. Worldwide, this type of albinism, the type 2 albinism, is present in about 1 in 40,000 people. In Tanzania, where Perpetua's from, it's 1 in 1,400 people. And because it's a recessive trait, that means that approximately 1 in 19 people are carriers for albinism in Tanzania.
So it's a recessive trait. In other words, it's a gene that isn't always expressed unless both parents give that recessive gene to the child, kind of like blue eyes, maybe, for some people?
Well, that's a very interesting comparison. Eye color is more complex, but amazingly, the trait for blue eyes is associated with the same gene, the OCA2 gene. That's the one that's common in Africa, in particular in Tanzania. So typically what we would find is we could have two normally colored individuals who are both carriers. So carriers are normally pigmented, and they have a 1 in 4 chance of having a child with albinism.
Well, let me turn this to Diane Vogel then. Diane, your organization is called the Asante Mariamu Foundation. It's named after a Tanzanian woman. Tell us just a little bit about her.
Sure. Mariamu Stafford was a 28-year-old mother of a toddler who was pregnant at the time, living in a small village in Tanzania. When sleeping in her bed with her toddler, she was woken in the middle of the night by a group of men. I believe it was about 4 or 5 men, pulled out of her bed and attacked with machetes. They chopped off her first arm. She rolled over to protect her son, who was sleeping in the bed with her, and they chopped off her second arm. She also recognized the voices of her attackers, and that plays into it later, becomes important later. But Mariamu had an amazing spirit, and she managed to keep herself alive and crawl, and it took about 9 hours until she got medical care. But after that attack, with her two arms taken, she was able to get to some neighbors and, as I said, 9 hours later, get medical care. We first learned of this issue after the attack, a year and a half after the attack, when ABC News did a special on her and brought her to the United States, where myself and some colleagues who were already involved in the American albinism community got involved. And it was after meeting her, being inspired by her story and learning that, you know, after she was fitted for prosthetics here and sent back home, we thought, how could we possibly let her go back home and let people this continue and just say, you know, have a nice life? We thought there must be something more that we can do. And from a human rights point of view, people with albinism are denied the most basic human right in Africa, which is the idea that they are human. They're not even viewed as human. So it was a really easy decision for myself and the founder of our organization, who we both went to law school together. So it was a really easy decision to say we have to do something about this.
And tell us, if you would, Diane, what are some of the strategies, what are some of the ways that your organization tries to educate people about this?
Sure. We work at a number of different levels, but mostly we are a very small volunteer-driven organization that works on the ground with partners who invite us into their communities in Tanzania or Uganda. We've done some other small sponsorships in a few other East African countries, but most of our work is in Tanzania and Uganda. Primarily, we do awareness, relief, and education and empowerment. And to give a very brief what those three are, awareness is, of course, encouraging and disseminating the information about albinism. As I always say, if me and my white husband gave birth to a black child, I would think it was magic too. I mean, if I had no other knowledge, I would agree with that. So our first thing is to make people aware of the biological backgrounds of this, the basics of genetics. And if you've never gone to school and you live in a rural community, you may not have any knowledge of this. We use very basic ways to get it. We partner with health organizations on the ground or schools on the ground. And we have five, you know, a small bullet point, the five myths about albinism. You know, people are not ghosts. They are people. Their intellectual capacity is the same as yours. The only thing that is different is their eye color, their skin color, and their ability to withstand the sun. Those kinds of things. And we put these messages out in simple ways, like we have bracelets that in Swahili, we do everything in the local languages. And in Swahili, for instance, we say, watu wenye ualbinu ni binadamu kama sisi, which means people with albinism are just like you and me. And everyone we meet, everywhere we go, gets two bracelets. We have the rule that is take one and teach one.
Diane, let me just stop you there, because actually you raised a point that I wanted to talk to Murray Brilliant about,
sure,
too, and that is the issue of exposure to the sun. I understand that that's a focus of some area of research, because skin cancer, particularly in places near the equator, is very common among people with albinism, is it not? What sorts of research, what sorts of medicine is there for treating this?
So skin cancer is very common among people with albinism in Africa. We know that 60 to 65% of individuals with albinism will develop skin cancer, and typically that's by age 40. This would be basal cell.
60 to 65% of people by age 40?
Yes.
Wow, that's an extremely high number.
What's really important is that these individuals, protect themselves against the sun by wearing, long sleeves, staying out of the sun. Hats are important. Sunscreen is important. And sunscreen is just not a typical item that one can obtain in a place like Tanzania. So the various organizations actually provide sunscreen and even manufacture sunscreen for people with albinism in Tanzania.
Diane Vogel, let me throw this to you. What about this issue of sunscreen? What does your organization do on this issue?
Over time, because it is true that sunscreen is crucial, but the most important thing is education about sun awareness and prevention on their own, because sunscreen is a depleting a depletable asset. So the first thing we do is teach people about long sleeve hats, sunglasses, and long pants, and then sunscreen on the small areas that are exposed, back of the hands, bottom, you know, tops of the feet if they're wearing open shoes, back of the neck and ears if those are not covered by the hat. It is important that we have been working also recently with governments to understand that a sunscreen must be identified as an essential medication or an essential medicine alongside things like HIV antiretroviral drugs, so that when they're imported to a country, it is not taxed, because right now it's viewed as a health and beauty product only for, and it's so expensive, it's only for tourists in a place like Africa where most of the population has a natural sun protection by having black skin or darker skin. So that's an important aspect. The government has a possibility here of really making a difference with sunscreen by putting it on the list of essential medications. I can say that.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about the challenges faced by people with albinism in East Africa. Joining us from Marshfield, Wisconsin, is Murray Brilliant. He studies the genetics of albinism and is deputy director of the Marshfield Clinic. Also joining us is Diane Vogel in Arlington, Virginia. She's a former public radio show producer and is now director of outreach for the Asante Mariamu Foundation, an aid organization that works with people with albinism in East Africa. Let me just turn this to Murray Brilliant. One thing that I wanted to ask you was, what are the specific goals of researchers? Is this something, is the idea that this will be something that can be cured in the future, or is this something that the goals are somewhat different than the idea of sort of curing people from having albinism? Does that make sense?
As you mentioned, albinism doesn't affect anyone's cognition, their brain function. These people are if anything, very smart and such. What it does affect is vision. So people with albinism often have very, very poor vision, even to the point where they might be considered legally blind. So our goal in research is to try to identify drugs that could be given that could ameliorate the vision problems, that could address these vision problems, especially in younger children as the visual system is developing. So we work with colleagues across the United States and actually internationally on projects that currently we're evaluating two different drugs that we feel have potential to help individuals with albinism see better.
Well, Diane Vogel, if I could go back to you then. I understand that one of the goals of your aid organization is to create different kinds of projects that give people livelihoods and sustainable incomes. Tell us just a bit about that.
Sure. Yes. Part of our awareness, relief, and education and empowerment is if we have empowerment programs for people. We have economic empowerment programs. For example, women's cooperative sewing project or a chicken raising and chicken farming project. These are open to adults and teenagers who may not be going on to school further, but who and to parents of children with albinism. So that what we do is we work again with people on the ground. We bring in we identify someone in country who is already doing something positive like this, but perhaps is not doing it with a population that has albinism. We connect with that, a working cooperative, as we have with a group called Albino Peacemakers out of Moshi in Tanzania. We will sponsor or bring or identify five or six people, women with albinism or parents of children with albinism. We will cover their costs to travel somewhere, be educated about how to create a sewing cooperative. We arranged for them to have sewing machines and then also brought in ways to for them to learn to market themselves and to connect their products with, say, ecotourism lodges that bring through well-heeled tourists every week or every month. And now these women's work is on display at several eco lodges, and there is now a self-perpetuating way for a mother with of a child with albinism or for an older person with albinism to have an income. The other side of that for us, we believe that the most important thing about albinism is to normalize it, to make people realize that there is nothing different about someone except the color of their skin and perhaps the acuity of their vision. As such, we also sponsor scholarship education. We have 19 Asante scholars, children who, when we first met them, were not in school because their parents could not afford either the cost of uniforms or the cost of transportation to get them to school or the like. We identified them as promising students from, again, our partners on the ground identified them for us.
Well, it sounds like there's a very robust aid effort then that includes not just education, but livelihood and helping people connect with jobs as well. But our time grows short. And so, Murray Brilliant, I thought I would give you the last word. Where do you see this issue moving over the next 5 years, 10 years? Do you anticipate that in 2025 or 2030, this issue will look much different in this part of the world?
I certainly hope it will look much different. One of the things that's important to understand is that in Tanzania, for example, and actually throughout much of Africa, the particular genetic cause of albinism is one that we can trace back to an ancient ancestor. So what we find is that people with albinism in Africa, for the most part, descend from a common ancestor. And this common ancestor lived about 2,500 to maybe even 6,000 years ago. So this is an ancient genetic trait that may be perpetuated because it has some advantage, perhaps an advantage for people who are carriers. One of the hypotheses that we've been exploring is that that people with albinism are protected from things like tuberculosis and leprosy.
I'm sorry, Murray. We're going to have to leave it there. We're just out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Diane Vogel, Murray Brilliant, and Perpetua Sankoro for joining us. Our lead producer this week is Edom Kasse, with Rachel Foster Gimbel and Lauren Wartman in studio. Travis McMillan is our director. Pat Akers is our audio engineer. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. We'll leave you with a clip from a Tanzanian reggae singer with albinism named Ras Six. Nabaki, 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 nabaki.